Hey, it's Antrese, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. My guest today is Michael Ryan. Michael Ryan is an artist living and working in the Netherlands. In this episode, Michael and I talk about how he ended up moving from New York to the Netherlands, and after a few trips back and forth, how he ended up making it his home. Michael created over 50 commissioned portraits in the first 3 years that he lived there. He shares his insights on creating commissioned work, adjusting to a new culture, and connecting with his models. Michael and I also talk a lot about the mindset of the artist, how he sets him up to be creative and present in his painting through walking meditations and thought work. As usual, this is a long-ranging conversation, jam-packed with insights for your painting and studio time. Before we get started on this episode, though, I wanted to just quickly let you know that we have several painting workshops coming up. If you are listening to this episode when it comes out, that's April 1st, 2021, I will be teaching a workshop on values that starts next week. Then in May, we have a portrait painting workshop with Ricky Mujica. And if you're still kicking yourself for missing Dean Fisher's still life painting workshop, he's back. At the end of May, he will be teaching a workshop on the figure in the interior. You can find out more about all of these workshops and sign up at savvypainter.com. Just click on the workshops tab. And you might want to keep an eye on that because we are adding more and more often. Okay, here is Michael Ryan.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you, Antrese. Thanks for having me.
So I would love to hear from you to start off with. Here's the question I've been dying to ask you since we've been in the green room chatting a little bit. You are a native New Yorker living in Amsterdam.
Yes.
Tell me all about that. I want to hear that story.
Okay. It's an amazing story. I was fortunate enough to attend two art academies in New York, the National Academy of Design and the Art Students League. And luckily as well, I had scholarships, but that did not pay my rent and keep food on the table. So I worked as a waiter in a French restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. And in November of 1980, I don't know if you were born yet, I had two Dutch businessmen as guests. And we got to talking. And at one point, as I was bringing him his courses, he asked, "So what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm your waiter." And he said, "Well, I mean, besides that." And he said, "Well," I said, "I'm an art student." And, "Oh, really? Oh, what do you paint?" And I said, "Still lives, portraits, figure." "Oh, that's interesting." Finally, at the end of the meal, I handed him his check and he handed me back his business card and asked if I would travel to the Netherlands and paint his two sons' portraits for my home. And I was flabbergasted, of course, and got in contact with him, and he was very serious. And in July of 1981, my partner and I, the two of us, flew to Amsterdam. And I remember we were starting to descend. The plane was descending towards the airport, and she turned to me and said, "Are you going to remember this guy?" I said, "Yes, I remember he was very tall." Well, when I arrived, I had not yet been informed that the Dutch are the tallest race in the world. So everywhere at the airport were these Canadian people. But I recognized him and he became my sponsor. I painted his son's and his wife's portrait. And then my partner and I, we traveled through Europe, checking out the art in every church, in every museum in Spain and France and Italy. And he had some contacts, which people we stayed with. And he gave us their second car to travel with. And we had Eurail pass it, but he said, no, take the car. And I said, okay. So I brought the car back and thanked him for everything. And he said, "Well, while you were away, you now have 15 portrait commissions." And he had organized with three other friends. So I had four people as sponsors. They organized my first exhibition. And it was such a success that he said, "I have the feeling your career is starting here in the Netherlands." And that's how it all got started.
Okay. Come on. This is
Yeah, a fairy tale.
Who is that? Okay, I'm blanking now, but there's a super famous actress from the 1950s, I think, who was discovered. It wasn't Marilyn Monroe, but it was somebody in that era who was discovered at a fountain drinking a soda or whatever at a fountain plate, at a soda pop.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know that Jane? I think it's Jane. I don't know. But it sounds like that to me. So you're a waiter. Had he seen your work?
No, he said, "Please send me photos." And I said, "Of course, okay." And luckily, I was copying a Rembrandt at the Metropolitan Museum at the time. So I sent that along. So that made an impression. But he liked my work. And interestingly enough, I learned later that he had done something similar a year or two earlier with a Swedish poet. He was not someone who was very focused on the arts. He was the director of a company in Holland. But he was someone who really, he was sensitive and he had a strong feeling about people. And if he saw someone that picked up a vibe and he thought, this guy's interesting, I want to help him out. And that's how it started.
Human beings are amazing. Sometimes, like when you hear stories like this, it's like, okay, we're not all that bad, right?
It reinforces your belief in humankind. It's amazing.
So you said this happened in 1980. I actually was born.
Okay.
1980s-ish?
Yeah, 1981. And I stayed for 3 years. And in those 3 years, I started with my Dutch gallery, which I'm still with 35, 36 years later. And the ING Bank has a huge art collection of about 20,000 pieces. It's been sized down now, but they started collecting my work. So everything started quickly for me here. I had my first gallery show, and that was sold out. And I was everything was happening so fast. Also, in those 3 years, I did about 50 portrait commissions in Holland and England, Belgium. And everything was happening very quickly, unexpectedly. And I was a little thrown. And I decided, we both decided, I said, I need to get out of here. I need to go back to the States. We rented a house and I needed to get myself grounded. I had been through 3 art academies and about 5-6 years of study. And I had my tools. I had my technical tools, but I needed to get in touch with myself and find out how I wanted to use these tools, what I wanted to use them for. I didn't want to just exercise my technical abilities. So we rented a house and I started keeping dream journals, for instance, and dream sketchbooks and reality journals and reality sketchbooks, and started experimenting with those two realities. And that was also around the time that I got interested in, it wasn't exactly Thich Nhat Hanh and Zen Buddhism, but in some fashion, I began to get in touch with being in the moment and mindfulness. And that was already in 1985.
Got it. So we'll get back to Thich Nhat Hanh and all of that in a moment.
Sure.
You totally piqued my interest. But I'm also curious, like, so you get there and it's just a tsunami, basically, of things happening for you, sounds like.
Yes.
50 portraits in 3 years?
Yes.
50 commissioned portraits, I should say.
Commissioned portraits. And what was also very interesting was I did most of those portraits in the homes of people, mostly, I'd say the most part, the wives of my commission givers and children, young children, not, you know, above around 12 or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's almost one a month, 50 in 3 years, 36 months. That's more than...
Yeah, that was a lot. And I was in the homes of people all over the Netherlands. I was having my own initiation into the country. I was becoming intimately involved with different areas of the country and, you know, being right in people's living rooms.
At that point, how well did you speak the language?
Not very well at all. When I first arrived in Holland, I heard those guttural sounds and I thought, this is not going to be something I'm going to be able to master. But I eventually did. But what's interesting is, and I tell the Dutch people, I said, you're used to hearing Italian, Spanish, other languages, maybe German. But Dutch I heard for the first time in the Netherlands. I'd never heard the language before.
Right. So you're, okay, I just have to, like, I'm putting myself in your position because I know, I spoke a little bit of Spanish when I got to Argentina. So at least I was familiar with the sounds. But I still couldn't immediately separate words. You know, at first, there were just a few words that I knew and somebody would say something and I'm like, they're talking about a house. And that's it,
yes.
Right? So I'm just trying to imagine this situation. You go there, you're getting all these commissions, you're in people's houses. First of all, you're in a new country and you're doing all these commissions. Did you feel like pressure? And then also, how did you do that not knowing the language?
Well, for instance, there was one little girl, she was, I think, about 10 years old. She was taking instructions from me in English.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she spoke French. And her French grandmother was reading French fairy tales to her to keep her quiet. That's the typical. The Dutch really know their languages.
Yeah.
And they have. It's a country that's a quarter of the size of New York State. And if you want to do business with people, because they're a trading nation, just picture if you're in New York, you have to also keep the parallel, the metaphor. You need to learn Connecticut, New Jersey, to speak Connecticut, New Jersey, and Massachusetts if you want to do any business. So that's why there's so languages. Yeah.
Yeah, and most Europeans know multiple languages.
Yes.
And English is I think English and Spanish and Chinese are the most spoken language. I don't know if English is one of the most learned languages, but it seems like it might be. I don't know. I always assume here people at least can understand me if they don't speak it.
Well, I don't know how it is for you there, but here, most Dutch people speak English very well. So I would be struggling to say something in Dutch and they just stop and say, listen, we'll just speak English, no problem.
I know. So it made it- I mean, that's so comforting, but at the same time, it slows down. People do that here too as well.
They do, yeah.
Most are taught English in school, and then it just depends on how much they continue to practice it or how, you know, kind of in the same way that, you know, I lived in LA, most of us were taught Spanish when we were young.
Sure,
in school,
sure.
But whether you remembered any of it is a whole other question.
Yeah, you learn it, but you don't exercise it. Yeah,
exactly. If you don't use it, you lose it. So I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I am very curious because I know it's a big topic for other artists, the pressure of commissions. I'm so curious about this because a lot of artists, they get a commission and oftentimes will sort of just freeze on it. And here you are. I was guessing that some of those people, at least some of them, spoke to you in English, but I was just so curious.
Yes, like, yes.
You're in a new country. And then you've got this intense workload of all these portraits. And how did that feel for you? How did you manage that? What was it like for you?
I like doing portraits and I like connecting with people and trying to pull out the essence, and get it on the canvas. And also I want to express myself and I want to express the truth that I'm feeling from someone, which often, well, not often, but sometimes got me into trouble because I saw things that maybe I didn't want to see and didn't want to paint. That's what I was picking up. I like to please people. I want them to be happy with the portrait. And for instance, in New York, I had some private lessons with a well-known portrait painter. And he had a system. He said, when you start your portrait, you ask a third of the amount down payment, pay for your supplies and materials and your time. When you get about halfway through the portrait, there should be a third party, an objective person who will look at how it's going and give his thumbs up or his thumbs down. And if it's thumbs up, you go ahead. And when it's finished and everyone's happy and you've made some corrections, if the person giving the commission would like a few changes, and when that's completed, everyone's happy, you get your down payment. Well, I began with that, but very quickly, I didn't like it. I felt that my hands were tied. So I started my own system. I said, let me just do the portrait. Don't pay me anything. And when it's finished, if you like it, pay me the full amount, it's yours. And if you don't, I take the portrait home, you don't pay me anything. It was a financial risk, but I felt very free then to do my work.
Yeah, a huge financial risk, but that system, I have not heard of the thirds, but usually what I've heard is 50% up front and then 50% where they like it. And so they're basically mitigating the like in-between part. When you did that, how did you feel? Like, what did that do for your art to know that you sort of had that like, not the pressure of these milestones that you had to hit and you could just focus on it. Did your work change at that point in terms of commissions?
Well, what happened was actually I was doing a lot of portraits, as you know, but it began to happen. I did some big family portraits with cats and dogs, but normally it was just head and shoulders and it would be this or it'd be this or it'd be this. And I began to think, is this going to be the rest of my life? And after those 3 years, I decided, and when I went back to the States, I decided, I just don't want to be doing just portraits. I don't want to be known as a portrait painter.
Right.
I want to be doing other things. I don't want to narrow myself. So when I came back to the Netherlands after a year away, my portraits began to change because I was doing more and more of my own work. My style was developing. I was introducing a lot more color. Things were loosening up. And so more or less the guarantee of the likeness and the style that people were getting the first 3 years, that was slowly falling away. And people were getting where I was at as an artist at that point.
Right. Okay. So I was just really curious about that. I know a lot of artists are very curious about the commissions and how other artists deal with it, because it is such a, for some people, it is the best source or a very good source of income for them, but it also causes, they also experience a lot of stress from it. So I know, like, that's a
it's the desire to please. And I think every artist has that at a different level. But for me, that's why I initiated my own system to balance that, the need to please and also the need for myself to do what I consider the best artwork I can do.
So you're there in the Netherlands and then you go back to New York. What did that do for you? I mean, so we have the benefit now of hindsight. We know you went to New York and then you went back to the, right? So I would love to hear that story of what you experienced in New York and why you decided to go back.
Well, I went to New York to get myself grounded, to learn how to apply the tools that I had learned from the art academies and apply them to what it was I wanted to do and get in touch with what I wanted to do, to give that space to myself. When I went back in 19, we both went back in 1985, and we were there for about 2 years. And then I had a real difficult time because my partner, we split up, and I hit a point of we were each other's anchor and balance in this foreign country. And when that happened, I was really thrown off balance and my painting suffered. And I finally decided after about a year separated to go back again to New York. And I had a show in San Francisco at the Montgomery Gallery in Westport, Connecticut. And I ended up renting another fairy tale. I rented a room in a castle that was built by, I can't remember the guy's name, very famous American composer. He built it for his wife as a wedding present. And it was on the Hudson in Dobbs Ferry. And I rented a room there and got myself, I had realtor friends who arranged that for me. And then I was dating a woman in New York, and she saw an ad in the Village Voice about a church in upstate New York near Woodstock that was for rent. And I went there and I rented this church, and I lived and painted in this church for a number of years. And that was fantastic. That was really nice. There was a period of, you know, with the separation and moving again back across the ocean of a lot of, I was very unsettled. And that was a difficult time to get myself back in balance again.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I know moving back and forth, it takes a lot. I've done it several times and I sort of like take it as I'm like, okay, fine. This is a thing that we're doing and I don't think that much about it. I mean, I do, but I don't. But that on top of the emotional, that split must have been very difficult.
Right.
So you go back to New York. How many times now? So that's twice moving back and forth.
Yeah, I went from New York to Holland for a year to New York, went back to Holland for 2.5 years, and now I'm back to New York again.
Now you're back living in a church in upstate New York.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. And churches are meat. We have a friend who lives in a church in a tiny little village in the middle of France, and we went to visit, and I was just like, never seen that before and thought it was the most amazing thing in the world. So,
It's wonderful.
Yeah, incredible. And while you were there, am I correct that then you were sort of experiencing, did you say difficulties painting? Is that where you sort of?
No, at that point I was getting settled back, my feet settled back on the ground, and I flourished there. That went very well. And I started another relationship, and on her property in the woods, I built a huge studio, which at that point I had a gallery in New York and a gallery in Amsterdam. And there I was doing well and built my studio. And that went, that was fantastic.
Okay, can I ask I have to do this because I've got, I don't remember how many people that have asked me this question, because going back and forth between the U.S. and Argentina, your art, your supplies, shipping, all that stuff, was that an issue for you? All the work that you create at that time and going back and forth with that?
Well, luckily I had the gallery in Amsterdam, at that point outside of Amsterdam. Later they moved to Amsterdam. So I left things there and I just bought new supplies and things in the States. That's how we worked that out.
But for the actual paintings, was there any issue like moving? So you just left all of your paintings there, went to the new place and just kind of started over effectively?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much. And what happened was it was getting difficult because I would have some paintings that I'd be shipping to the gallery in Amsterdam and Europe, and others would be going I'd be driving 2.5 hours down to New York to deliver the paintings there on stretchers. And the ones going to Europe had to go off the stretchers, rolled up in tubes, which I carry with me to down the air, and then restretch them back there. It was a lot of work. And at a certain point, I decided, why don't I just tape the canvas onto the wall with strong tape and stretch it like I would a canvas. And I got very accustomed to that hard painting on canvas. Yeah, not that flapping canvas, but very hard surface. And so when I finished, if a painting needed to go to Europe, simply had to roll it up and stretch it once there. or stretch it once to go to New York.
Got it. I mean, I know this is, I get asked this all the time too, and I have so many different ways that I transport paintings that, believe me, like a lot of people are like, wait, so what do you do? How do you do that? And how did you get it back and forth? And I mean, I think, you know, as we're hearing here, just to fill in the blanks for people, it's so different depending on the countries too, where you're going and what the rules slash laws are about bringing paintings in and out.
Yeah,
you do have to do your research, and it very much depends on the country. So we can't answer all of the questions about that, but we can at least give you an idea of what it's like.
Yeah, you need to do your homework.
Yes, I've discovered that the hard way here. Okay, so all the logistics moving back and forth. Let's talk about, now I would love to hear, what are you currently working on? What are you currently obsessed with now in your studio?
Okay, right now I'm doing a series of landscapes inspired by nature here with water. And we have a trailer there and a little garden, and you park your car and you cross a bridge over the water and to get to this little island and where other caravans are, and it's very inspiring. And I get up before sunrise, and I sit on that bridge, and I look out over the water, and it's like looking at a movie screen where a new film is showing every morning, and you've never seen it. It's never a rerun. It's fantastic. And a while ago on Instagram, someone had posted something from this book and this author, Maggie Nelson, called Bluettes. And she posted a passage from that, and I'll read it. 15 days after we are born, we begin to discriminate between colors. For the rest of our lives, barring blunted or blinded sight, we find ourselves face to face with all these phenomena at once and recall the whole shimmering mess color. So I borrowed the phrase shimmering mess, and that had a lot of significance for me, especially related to being in the moment. When I give a workshop, I tell my students, we always begin with a walking meditation to bring ourselves into the moment and to stop our thinking and to become very visual, to observe. And then they, one student might say, I feel very attracted to this area. I'm going to start here. And I said, what are you going to paint? And they'd say, well, I'm going to paint these roses with the tulips behind and the oak trees in the background. I say, okay. But you need to drop the name rose and tulip and oak tree and just see what is in front of you. That's what you need to paint. Because when you're painting, it can be easy if you decide not to make it difficult. And doing that
just
makes
like
it difficult.
Thinking and life and everything else, it can be so easy if we would just stop making it
difficult. So don't label the things with your knowledge. Stay stupid and just observe what's in front of you and paint it. Don't try to describe it. So that whole shimmering mess idea, just seeing color and relating colors, that really intrigues me. Because after all, realism and abstract painting, it's all abstract. It's all colors on a two-dimensional surface. It's all abstract painting. So I try to help my students put those colors down in a way that is expressive, that's balanced, that makes a good composition.
Yeah, this is something that we've talked about many times, but like you said, it is, well, I would say it's very, very simple, extremely simple, but it is not easy. And this idea of not naming the shapes, and I'm curious, so not naming the shapes, I think that, or not naming the objects more accurately, I think is something that people sort of intellectually understand. And then when it comes time to actually do it, it is still the thoughts in our heads keep saying, that's a rose, that's a rose, that's a rose, that's a tulip, that's a petal of the tulip, that's the something behind it, right? So I suspect, I have a suspicion that you have a very interesting answer for this. I don't know, but that whole idea does require just 100% being in the moment and stopping the chatter. And so I would love to hear from you some of your insights, advice on how do you describe that to people who maybe know it intellectually, but when it comes time to do it, they just cannot stop those words in their head that say, that's a tulip.
It's like trying to describe meditation. You can't describe meditation. You have to experience meditation. Paint at least 3 hours a day. But before I begin painting, I spend 3 hours getting ready to paint. I like to get up around 7 in the morning on a perfect day. Of course, things get in the way, but a perfect day would be waking up at 7, doing 45 minutes, an hour of yoga, having showering, breakfast, and then taking an hour-long walking meditation, meaning walking, your steps synchronized with your breathing. So if you're aware of your breathing, you can't be thinking. You can't be thinking about things because you're aware of your breathing. You can't do the same two things at the same time. You
can't walk and chew gum at the same time.
Something like that. So if you're aware of your breathing, now I'm breathing in, now I'm breathing out, to put it very simply, it keeps your thoughts down. And you'll find, I myself at times, you know, reeling out, I'll be walking and I'll say, oh, look at that house. That's a nice house. It's a nice room there. Oh, yeah, it makes me think of my own room, my studio. Yeah, those paintings I'm working on. I wonder what I should do with that one painting. And I go, okay, I'm doing it. And I just reel it all back in, become aware that I'm breathing again. And you can, I always think you can do two things when you're doing, for instance, a walking meditation. You can get angry at yourself that you were thinking, or you can congratulate yourself that you realized you were thinking and you brought yourself back again. Mm-hmm.
That is the purpose of the meditation, right? In very simplistic sense, to just be aware that you're thinking. So if the first time you meditate, you spend 45 minutes thinking about everything in your studio, and then you go, oh, no, I'm coming back now. That's kind of like the first step. And that realization means that it was, to me at least, means that it was successful. If you need to decide that it's successful, that it was a successful meditation.
Or just that's why I start the workshops in the mornings with a walking meditation to help the students calm their minds down. And, you know, worrying about what they're going to do, are they going to do it well, things like that. Just quiet their minds down so they can focus.
Exactly. I love it. And do you find that process, I'm curious, for painters who are not accustomed to that idea, but for students who understand that intellectually and maybe continually have problems as they're painting it, what advice do you give them if they notice, I'm thinking too hard?
Well, one thing you can do is when you're looking at the object, the tulip, go ahead and look at the tulip, try to keep your mind quiet, and then look at your canvas. And you could recognize the object as a tulip, but on your canvas, it's color on a two-dimensional surface. And that helps you realize you're working with colors. You're painting with colors. That color will never be a tulip, if you want to stay with the word tulip. That color will never be that object you're looking at. It's two separate things. You are translating it.
I love it. So it is like, I'm very reluctant to come off as like I'm an expert on meditation because I'm so far from it. But something that has been very helpful to me when practicing meditation is just to, when I catch that, it's just that those are words, that's a thought, that's it. And then it helps me ground me and come back. So what I'm hearing, what sounds, and I've never heard it described this way, so I'm kind of having a like, wow, this is fantastic, is that while you're painting, it's just the thought that that's a color, that's a shape.
Yeah, I never do sitting meditation. I try to be meditating all the time in the sense that when you're speaking, I give you all my attention. That's meditating. When I'm speaking, I'm aware that I'm speaking and I try to do it mindfully and choose my words well. When I'm painting, I'm aware of the color I just put down and how is that relating to things that are already existing on the canvas. What occurred then? What just happened when I put that orange down? What did the other colors do? It's almost like when I was in the subway in New York, I had a habit. I would walk into the subway and I would look at it as a scene from a play. And I'd say, okay, these are all the actors. This is the stage. Then the subway would stop. They'd leave and a new set of actors would come in and all the relationships changed again. And it was so interesting. Like a canvas.
That would make
when you put a new color down, it all shifts again.
Yeah, it changes everything. That sounds like you've transformed riding the subway into a really fun event.
Being a choreographer of a director, yeah.
Yeah, but back to the canvas then, I love this idea of, it's almost like every brushstroke is a new person who walked onto the subway.
Yes, and there's always something you have an intention, there's something you'd like to accomplish with the painting. But at the same time, while you're on the way to achieve that, things are happening. Be aware of what's happening that are not intended, that might just shift you in a new direction. Because that idea that you, or the intention, can be a metaphor for the tulip also. You want to paint the tulip. I want to paint the idea that I had when I began. But while you're underway, that can change again.
And what's so powerful about this, just the other piece of it, is that presence that you mentioned, and not, while you're painting, being present with the current painting as it exists at that moment.
Exactly.
As opposed to the idea that you have in your head or what somebody else might think of it later on.
yes, there's the idea you start with, but now you're 45 minutes or 2 hours later, and there's something else happening.
Yeah.
What is
and how exactly?
Another thing that I do, Entrees, is I always have a sketchbook with me. And if something grabs me or something strikes me, I pull it out and I write it down. I write notes. I write poetry or my emotions. And in the studio when I'm working, I'll suddenly get something and I'll write it down. I grab some things here and I tack them to the wall. Here's one. Arrived in your studio, no inspiration, head empty, scared, doubtful. Good for you. Let's go.
Love that.
When nothing is happening, be patient, be calm. When you receive a glimpse of inspiration, attack, move, let nothing delay or obstruct you. So these are things that pop in my head and I write them down so I know they're going to be useful to me. And I just keep shifting them on the wall of the studio when something new comes up. Another one, when you fail to make a decision, the subject dictates to you. When you make a strong decision, your chosen direction will continually inform you.
I love that. These are fantastic. That first one I love so much just because I think it's probably just on my mind because I've been having a lot of conversations with artists about this, about, you know, sometimes they go into the studio and they're, you know, maybe the night before or that morning when they were having their coffee, they're very excited about going into the studio. But when they get there, it's kind of like a deer in the headlights. It's like, okay, what do I do now? Why am I, you know, like all the thoughts just come pouring in. Why am I painting? What does it matter that, you know, like all of that?
Yeah, that's where the meditation comes in again. If you're feeling scared, okay, be scared. When I was on a Zen Buddhist retreat, I was sitting listening to a lecture of Thich Nhat Hanh, and I belonged to a little family there. You've broken up into families. And I did some little portraits of them. And I thought, before I leave, I'm going to go into the office there and do Xerox copies and hand them out to the other members of the family. So I'm at the copy machine, and I'm really getting frustrated. I'm confused, and I don't know how the machine works, and I'm getting stressed out. And there was a young monk there, and he smiled at me and put his hands together, and he bowed, and he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's the machine. I'm confused." And he gave me this big smile, and he put his hands together, and he bowed, and he said, "Enjoy your confusion." And he walked away.
And so, did that help?
Meaning, right now, at this moment, you're confused. Yeah. Enjoy it, because it's going to pass in a matter of minutes, probably.
Yeah,
so when you're scared,
decide that it's the worst thing ever.
Be with it. Let it shift. Don't try to escape it. Just be with it, and it'll shift. It'll change again.
Yeah, I think like that meditation, life, painting, it's all same thing. But it's such a beautiful example of, you know, I know people experience this, whether, well, right now. So whether it's a photocopy machine, whether it's technology, whether it's painting, when things don't go the way that you expect them to go, when you're in the middle of a live interview and it just drops out, you can make that into a horrible event, or like, oh my God, what happened? You can make that into a catastrophe just with your thoughts, or you can go, oh, the internet's being the internet. We're all still here. Let's just keep going.
Yeah, it's wrong. It just happened. That's all.
Yeah. And allow things to happen the way that they happen. Allow yourself to not be knowledgeable about a machine and trust that you can figure it out, or you know that there's somebody that you can ask, probably. Can you please show me how to use this machine? I'm sure somebody there could have done that for you, or you could have used your mind and figure, you know, like not allowed the confusion to mean something was wrong. Just be like, oh, okay, no way.
Right. Or when you're in the studio and you don't like your work and you're doubting yourself as an artist or as a painter, be with that. If you try to escape from it, if you try to get rid of it often, you'll exacerbate it. You'll start saying, I don't like my paintings today. I doubt myself and I'm not a good artist. I never will be a good artist. It starts to get worse and worse because you're unable to just be with it and let it move.
Yeah.
It's just a cloud through.
Yeah. So true. I'm sure like there's, you know, 100 people taking notes right now.
But it's hard to be with it. You want to get away from it.
Yeah, the resistance of it and our thoughts about it is what causes, I'm just blanketly calling it pain, the suffering, whatever it is that you're experiencing, the uncomfortableness, that is all generated by resisting it, the thoughts in our head about it, and not just allowing it to, as you say, pass like a cloud through it. I really do love this idea. And this,
yoga is similar in that yoga is a moving meditation. When you're in a difficult asana and you can't hold the pose, that's the moment when you try to relax and breathe and make yourself comfortable in an uncomfortable physical position. Just be with it and relax into it. And don't try to say, I can't hold this, I can't hold this, and try to get out of it. Just be with it and let it change.
I love it. And this idea of just allowing yourself to not know what to do next on your painting for a few minutes.
Yes. Oh my God. If you don't know, everything's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think oftentimes we make it, if I don't know, is often used as a weapon against ourselves to mean that we're not capable, that we're less than, that we're, I don't know, fill in the blanks for all of the things that we make that mean for ourselves. When, as you said, I don't know, could also be like, oh my God, there's so many possibilities right now. Or, wow, what's going to happen next? Let me find out. Or, isn't this interesting? I'm so curious what, you know, the paint will do next, or what will happen if I mix this color and add it, you know, like all of those things can turn, I don't know, from a scary, terrible thing to, or something that means that you're not worthy to call yourself an artist, maybe, to, I tend to use the word adventure. So.
Yeah. I mean, like you were saying, it's about being human. I remember a number of years ago, we were in Vienna. It was Gustav Klimt's 150th birthday, I believe. And there was a glimpse everywhere in the museums. And in one museum, there was a vitrine that snaked through about three or four rooms. And in the vitrine were all postcards he had written to a woman friend of his that was his friend all through life and his conversational partner. And they were very open with each other. And Klimt, of course, did some beautiful portraits. And in some of the, a few of the postcards, one in particular, he was talking about a portrait he had been working on or was working on. And I can't remember the exact words, but it was something to the effect of, I'm not a portrait painter. Why do I even try to do this? I'm making a mess of it and I'm just going to give up. I can't do it anymore. And all of us artists, we have this idea that, yeah, we're not that good. But I mean, people like Gustav Klimt and Matisse and Picasso, they didn't have the problems we're having. Of course they did. It's not about we're less talented, they're more talented. They had or developed the ability to get out. To remain with it and to keep pushing through it.
I think it really comes down to how this helps me a lot to think about it this way is, am I willing to experience discomfort in the service of my art? Am I willing to be uncomfortable and to not know, to sit with that and not let it become this power that stops me from doing it? And I think like when you start to think about it that way, that like, oh, I'm just uncomfortable. Like nothing's wrong here. We're not entitled to be comfortable and happy and waltz into our studios, you know, as if we've been sprinkled with fairy dust and create without the flip side of it.
Right. It's hard work. I've been painting for over 50 years and I still have these days where I think I can't paint. I'm not an artist. And rather than believe it, I just say to myself, oh, there I go again. I'm having one of those moods. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there's those words again.
Yeah.
So shimmering mess.
Shimmering mess, yes.
Shimmering mess. I want to say, what exactly is that in your studio? But how is that manifesting itself in your studio? What tell us like a little bit more about like this series, what it is.
Well, that quote from the book was initiated something, recalled something. And when I started this series, I realized when I was a little kid, I was drawing at a very early age. And I remember very well that I went to my father, he'd be reading the newspaper and look what I drew. And he said, oh, that's very good, Michael. That's very good. And then he said, at one point, he saw me drawing and he thought I had been tracing the photos from the newspaper, but I was drawing them freehand. And then suddenly he was very impressed. So I had a lot of positive support. And I was the type of kid, whenever I drew something or later painted something and I was finished, I come racing downstairs and show it all to my parents, my brothers and sisters. Look what I made. I was not shy about it. So at an early age, I was trying to do things really well and do them correctly. Here I am now, many years later, and I have like this permission to just mess around with the colors and just enjoy the juiciness of them with palette knives and fingers. And I'm playing now, maybe for the first time, with colors. I'm playing with them, but I'm playing with them with a lot of background, a lot of technical ability in my backpack and my toolkit and a lot of experience. So it's sort of a guided playing. It's my training and my abilities and my experience are somehow in the background guiding me along while I'm playing. So it's fun. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, I love it. Just the idea that, I mean, just the words that you're using to describe it. I mean, one of the difficult things I think to resolve about being an artist is that we have this other language that is not verbal. And to try to translate that other language into words is sometimes extremely difficult for us. But when we can look at the expression of ourselves in this other language as a playful thing, as a fun thing, as like, I have all of these tools that I've accumulated over my lifetime. Let's see what happens. Let's see how I can put this together onto a canvas and accurately express this idea that I have.
Yes, there was, I've forgotten his name at the moment. There was a downhill skier in the 80s. I think his name was Alberto Bomba, something like that. Alberto, he was an Italian. He was this big guy, and he was a fantastic skier. And he would just, in the giant slalom, the downhill, he would explode out of the gate and just let himself rip. But it was, he had all this ability, and he knew the slope really well. And that kept him from just flying out of the curbs and off the trail. And so I sort of use him as a metaphor when I'm painting, that I can allow myself to just go, and I'm not going to do childish things because I have too much experience, but I'm enjoying the childish approach to it.
Yeah, that speed of just that kind of like abandon. I love that story of the skier. It reminds me of
Alberto Tomba. Sorry, that was his name.
Ah, I ski okay. I can make it down to the bottom of the mountain without killing myself or anybody else. he passed away recently, but he was almost like my second. I had multiple families like that adopted me. So I have several like second parents. So he was an amazing skier and skied. He didn't miss a season in 70 years when he passed away. Like the last season, he missed that. But we would talk about skiing and he would just, it reminded me of what you just said, because it looked like he skied faster than any, like he would just fly down that hill and fly down the mountain. Didn't matter what was in front of him and didn't slow down. He would just bonsai and go. And we talked about that a lot. And he said, no, he's like, a lot of people struggle with skiing because they're resisting the mountain. They're resisting the speed and they come off the slopes and they're exhausted. He's like, I use almost no energy to get down to the bottom because I've got it. He was also a computer scientist, so very, very analytical. And so he would tell me that he's like, I use the minimum amount of effort to get to the bottom, but I'm always in control. And it's an amazing like process.
Yes.
And to translate into the painting process and to what you're talking about, like this idea of both using all the tools without using the knowledge that you have and having fun with it, but also not making it any more difficult than it has to be so that you can enjoy that shimmering bath.
Yes, I have a sign here that says, be carefully reckless and totally let go while maintaining complete control.
I love this. I love this so much.
Well, it's something just popped in my head. I was listening to your interview with painter in San Francisco, and found it interesting how she described her day, that she first does all her emails and all the business stuff, and then she's free to do her work. And for me, it's just the opposite. I come out of my sleep, my dream state, and I don't look at anything. I do my yoga, my walking meditation, my painting, and then I'm allowed to do the business stuff and look at emails and social media.
I love it.
It helps keep me focused. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm rearranging my days lately and experimenting with a lot of stuff. And so, yeah, I have this rule. I broke it this week, though. I'm still practicing it, that I don't touch anything work related until 1:30 in the afternoon.
Very good.
Trying. And I did really well for a month, and then I will call it, I slipped. But it is like for me also, and everybody's different how they respond to the creative process and how they're able to schedule their days. But I'm finding that when I start my day with creativity and with mindfulness, that the rest goes so much faster and easier.
Yeah, I'm the same.
So for people who are listening to this, if you have any questions, go ahead and drop them in the chat wherever you are. If you're on YouTube or Facebook or in our community, we're watching all of those. Stephanie is asking how the pandemic has affected your work, Michael, creatively and or technically.
Mostly it's been very positive. I'm in the center of Amsterdam and its streets are much quieter and people are now leading their lives in a different way. A lot of people are living the way I've always lived. They're not leaving their homes. They're working at home. I have a live-in studio here. And so it's like, well, join the club. So actually, it's been positive. My life has not changed very much. I'm very focused. Of course, I miss meeting my artist friends in cafes here in Amsterdam. But my work just goes forward. And it reminds me of, and I've thought about it, that I'm aware of the pandemic. It affects me in like everyone else. A lot of people are suffering greatly from it. And it made me think of Henri Matisse, that he painted his beautiful flowers and interiors and gorgeous color combinations and his models. And at the same time, his daughter was working for the underground during World War II when the bombs were falling. He had to retreat to the coast. She was tortured and captured, and he didn't know what happened to her, but she eventually was all right. But he just kept painting the same subject matter, the same beautiful things. That's who he was. Mm-hmm. So if you look at Matisse's work, it's difficult to believe that a whole section of 4 or 5 years was during the Second World War, where he was painting and living in occupied France, but his work just went on. Whereas Picasso was painting La Guernica.
Right. I didn't know that about Matisse's daughter. That's fascinating. And to think of what was going on in throughout the world as he was creating. Really interesting.
Right. And there was a whole movement here in Europe. It was called Cobra. And it was very, after World War II, a very violently expressive, colorful explosion of art. From a Cobra is made up of the CO of Copenhagen, the BR of Brussels, and the A of Amsterdam, Cobra. Those were where the artists came from. And it was a reaction to the violence and the upheaval that happened during World War II. And those artists just were hit by that, and they had to get it back out again. Their world had changed, and they had that violence that they had experienced and put it back out there through art. Yeah. All artists are different how they react to the situations around them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I don't know what we'll see from artistically, what we'll see from this, there'll be changes, but I think that we all process things differently, and also that we process it through our art. So our art making is part of how we deal with what's happening, I guess. But I think for me also, same as you, almost nothing changed except the world got quieter.
Maybe after we're gone, people will look at, critics will look at our works. Obviously, this was the pandemic year in the art. We can't see it ourselves. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's such an interesting time in a way. It's so bizarre sometimes when I kind of pull my head up and really think about what's happening now. I think I've kind of, for me at least, I'm a homebody anyway. I love being home. I love being in my studio. So give me an excuse not to go out. I'll totally take that. But at the same time, my husband and I, we still got it back in November. Unfortunately, we're doing fine. I still have weird dizziness at random times, but we're basically unaffected by it, thank goodness. But I think the way that I'm trying to express it is the impact on it, on us as artists. I think if you can compartmentalize and not think about why it's happening, I think the impact has been a lot of creativity and a lot more time in the studio, mm-hmm. inside of a lot of stress and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of people personally knowing family, friends who have had it much worse than I did or who passed away. But there's always that kind of little cocoon, I would say, of our art that we can go back to and get some oxygen.
Yeah, but unfortunately, a lot of people who have lost their businesses or restaurants, clothing stores, but we painters, the art market, I think my experience is it hasn't been that bad. And also we just keep painting. We're building up our inventory. We just keep doing our work.
Sean is asking, I'm also a mindfulness painter. I sometimes find emotions arising unbidden and transitory and wish to paint them. Any advice about this?
Well, my experience with emotions is that they arise and they move off again. Maybe the parallel for me would be, that's why I have my sketchbook, to quickly write things down, to do a sketch. Also, sometimes I take a photo, but then you haven't done the work yet. You've done click with your finger, but you haven't done the work yet. You still have to break the photo down, pull the essence out, make some art out of it. When you make a drawing, you're doing the work of looking at 3,000 facts and pulling out a few lines and a few colors. The photo, you haven't done that work yet. So maybe write things down, do some sketches, and maybe come back to it at a certain point, and maybe when you're at a different place, and see how strong that is. Maybe that can be, it's still strong enough to initiate a painting, for instance.
And I love that description that you gave of the sketch of the 3,000 bits of information, distilling it. I'm completely paraphrasing and butchering it, but distilling that into a few lines, that is what we do and why sketching is so much more powerful, I think, than photography, even if I do rely on that sometimes too, hoping it will trigger the memory again.
I mean, when I take a photo and I bring it back to the studio, what I try to paint is not the photo. I try to paint the reason why I took the photo. Mm. Was it in that that attracted me? Or when you come back to the studio, you have the photo. It's in the photo, but there's also 3,000 facts that are in the way that you, and you have to dig it and pull it out. The work has to be done.
Yeah. So if you do have any other questions, go ahead, put that in now. And in the meantime, Michael, I'm curious from you, like, what wisdom do you want to impart to people, to artists who are listening?
From my own experience, what the advice I would give is, even though it's very difficult at times, trust in yourself. Don't try to be Matisse or Sean Scully or Doymans. Be Andreas Wood. You're unique. You're an individual. And you will never be here again. And no one like you will ever experience the world again so, like you experienced it. So please don't deny us what how you experience things. It's important.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. And one last question. I'm going to ask my favorite question and buy a little bit of time to see if any, make sure we caught everything to give Brenna enough time to pull it if we got it. My favorite question I always love to ask painters who come onto the show is if you could own a painting by any living artist, what would it be or by?
Yes, I know that that's a question I might receive. I immediately thought of someone who passed away recently, and that is Wolf Kahn, wonderful colorist. So officially, he's not eligible. So I go to my next choice, and that would be Sean Scully, an abstract painter. Do you know his work?
I do not, but now I will, which is the other reason why I love to ask that question, because I often learn.
Okay. He works with squares, mostly stripes, and he's abstract. But his work is so balanced, and so he's developed so much his own language, and it's so expressive. And it reminds me of when I'm at work in my own studio, and I'm not out of balance, and things aren't jiving, things aren't coagulating properly. Often I'll put on music from Bach. And when I do that, it just goes, voom! Everything just lines up for me. I don't know why, it just lines up. That's the feeling I get from the work from Sean Scully. It's just so solid and balanced and funk. It's an amazing quality he has.
That is unbelievable that you just said that, because if I put Bach on, I want to paint always. It's almost like a Pavlovian response, because I used to listen to it in art school in my figure painting classes. So if I put that on, I just go right there. So if I'm struggling, that's amazing that you said Bach, though. I've never heard anyone else say that. That's so exciting. Cool.
And it reminds me of something Edwiga said in the interview with her, that she's always amazed that when she paints something, that she's put something into it, a feeling, and she doesn't know if anyone's going to perceive it. And at the opening, people, they see it. And she's, wow, they can see that. And it reminds you that we're so very much connected more than we think.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much for joining us and for being on the show and for indulging me with all of my questions. And fantastic. All right. Thank you, everybody. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao, ciao.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast with Michael Ryan. Thank you so much again to Michael for sharing your time with us. We really, really appreciate it. Show notes for this episode are at savvypainter.com. You can see examples of Michael's work there, plus find links to connect with him. Just click on the podcast tab. This episode of the podcast was recorded live in the Savvy Painter community. If you have not joined us yet, you are totally missing out on the fun. You can get early access to the episodes and you can be there for live recordings. Join us at community.savvypainter.com. And finally, one last thing. Don't forget that my Understanding Values workshop starts next week. You still have time to join. Just go to savvypainter.com and click on the workshop tab. You can sign up there. We start on Tuesday, April 6th. 2021. And while you're there, you might want to check out some of the other workshops that we have coming up. I am super, super excited about this. This is something that we've been working on behind the scenes for a while now. We have workshops with artists who've been on the podcast, and there are varying lengths. Some of them are a few weeks. And then there are others that are shorter duration, just a few days. And then we'll be folding in some more like tutorials, just a couple hours of instruction or demonstration for you. So I'm super, super excited about this. We've been working really hard on it, and I'm so excited to be able to take some of the content from the podcast and bring it to you in a way that is more hands-on. So if you click on the workshops tab that is in the upper right-hand corner of the screen, usually it's in the menu, you'll find a list of all the workshops that we have coming up soon. And we will be adding more and more to those. We're just super, super excited. Can you tell? I've already said that like three times. Super excited to bring you these workshops. They're so much fun. Okay, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you in the community.